And this is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Ken Nash, and Mimi Rosenberg is on vacation this week. We're overdue for a public banking system. The federal government's response to the financial crisis has been a parade of bailout programs injecting public funds into the largest banks and financial institutions with precious little assistance for everybody else. As in the 1930s, Depression's failure to achieve a strong and sustainable recovery should open the door to other alternatives, such as a parallel banking public banking system at both the federal and state levels to fill the unmet credit needs stemming from the massive failures in private banking. In banks owned by federal and state governments, there is far greater public accountability in the bank's oversight. A public option in banking has a rich tradition in American history, which can serve as model today, including the 1930s Reconstruction Finance Corporation at the federal level and the Bank of North Dakota, which has been successfully operating since the 1930s and is the model for a number of attempts today at the state level, including California, to duplicate its success. And we have to talk about this. Tim Canova, Professor of International Economic Law at the Chapman University School of Law, and welcome to Building Bridges, Tim.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Why don't we set this up by talking about why we need parallel institutions? I know this is going to be a challenge, but in just a few minutes, if you could tell us why the present banking institutions are not doing their job.
Well, I think there are some very rational reasons that the private banking system is failing to do the job of steering people's deposits into loans for Main Street. And I guess the less nefarious explanation is simply that the economic conditions are so bad with, I think, about 14 million people officially out of work and another 10 million seriously underemployed, that it's just not that rational for businesses to be investing and banks to be lending on the kind of scale that's needed to change this economy, to revive it. I guess in addition to that explanation, we certainly see the private banks using their vast resources of people's deposits to engage in all kinds of derivative trading, more risky types of investments that are speculation on all kinds of things, such as sovereign debt in Europe, and they're not steering those funds into the real economy.
There are a number of proposals that you put forth to create a parallel banking system. Let's start with, in a way, the smaller ones first, although there could be 50 of them, and that's state banks using the Bank of North Dakota as a model. So why don't you tell our folks, we don't hear too much about that in New York City and New York State, even though, as I understand it, there are 12 states that are actively pursuing setting up similar systems. So why don't you talk a little bit about this Bank of North Dakota?
Sure. The Bank of North Dakota has been around since the early 1900s, and it's been a very successful bank. It's owned by the state of North Dakota. It was chartered in 1919. The state deposits all of its tax revenues into the Bank of North Dakota, which in turn ensures that a very high percentage of those funds are going to be invested in the state economy. The Bank of North Dakota is one of the leaders in the country, for instance, in student loans. And when you take a look at the interest rates they're charging on their student loans, much, much lower than private commercial banks would be charging students on loans. We're talking about loans that vary from variable rates of 2% to fixed rates up at around 6 to 7%. And it's not uncommon to hear of student loans that are more like around 13% and higher right now. So the Bank of North Dakota has a very big chunk of the student loan market, and it's making those loans at very affordable interest rates. It's also making lots of loans to commercial loans to small and medium-sized businesses in the state of North Dakota. It's even started a program in the past year, as I think you might know, to make loans to local subdivisions, governmental subdivisions in North Dakota that have been impacted by natural disasters, everything from tornadoes to flooding. So it's meeting a lot of needs of the state. And then in addition, the Bank of North Dakota is profitable. It's a very well-run bank. It engages in rather conservative banking practices, not engaged in these kinds of risky gambling derivative transactions. and its compensation for bank management is very modest. And, you know, as a result of the way it's run, it makes money and it remits a significant portion of its earnings back to the state treasury. In the past decade, it has remitted more than $300 million back to the North Dakota state treasury, which in a small state like North Dakota is a significant amount of money. And I should add that North Dakota is the only state in the country that has not had any kind of a budget crisis in the past 3 years, and it has the lowest unemployment rate in the country.
You know, we have a real problem in New York City with the MTA and also with other infrastructure projects because it costs so much to borrow money for these long-term projects, and the interest rates accumulate also, cutting into services. So what happens in North Dakota with a situation like that?
Well, North Dakota's bank, the Bank of North Dakota, is really a publicly owned commercial bank. So it's much more engaged in making commercial loans to small and medium-sized businesses, to homeowners, to students, and not really in the business of infrastructure investment. But there are public banks in the country that are devoted entirely to infrastructure investment. And right here in California, where I live, we have the California Infrastructure and Economic Development Bank, a state-owned bank that engages in infrastructure investment. The only problem is it's very undercapitalized. There were a number of bills that were passed by the California State Legislature in the last term, public banking bills, including one that would have it sought to expand the scope of the state infrastructure bank. And unfortunately, Governor Jerry Brown vetoed both of those measures. And one explanation for Governor Brown's veto is that his jobs czar is a former executive of Bank of America. The fact is, though, that we have already existing state infrastructure banks, and if we could sort of rev it up, that is a way to certainly expand infrastructure investment and start getting people back to work on very useful things, very useful projects.
There are a number of other states throughout the country that are looking at these state banks now, right?
Yeah, there are about, as I think you indicated, at least a dozen states that have bills that have been introduced and are pending. Here in California, I'm working with a number of legislative leaders, and we're looking to draft another bill that would, again, seek to expand the state infrastructure bank in two ways. One, to make it a vehicle for directing state tax revenues, deposits of tax revenues, into the infrastructure bank, which could then have an expanded authority to make commercial loans, but also to make it possible for the infrastructure bank to engage in larger infrastructure investments, to take investments from pension funds, from union trust funds. You know, there's, I should say, a connection between this kind of a vision of state public banking and federal efforts. And what I mean by that is we've seen over the last 3 years the Federal Reserve, you know, the nation's central bank, has engaged in what has been called quantitative easing programs, shorthand QE1 and QE2. And what these programs have done, under these programs, the Federal Reserve has purchased several trillion dollars of paper assets from private commercial banks, investment banks, hedge funds. The kind of paper assets that the Fed has purchased, $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities, another $600 billion or more of treasury bonds. So by purchasing those kinds of assets from the banks, it's obviously been good for the banks. It's a hidden bailout for the banks. It props them up. But it should be noted it doesn't cost the taxpayers a single penny because this is the Federal Reserve creating new monetary reserves out of thin air. There's talk already about the Federal Reserve engaging in a quantitative easing 3 program where it would purchase another $1 trillion or more of mortgage-backed securities from Wall Street banks. Well, it raises the question, if the Fed can do that for Wall Street, couldn't the Fed do something like that for Main Street? If it could purchase trillions of dollars of paper assets from Wall Street banks, surely it could pump a couple of $100 billion into state infrastructure banks. And again, it wouldn't cost the taxpayers a penny. It doesn't add to the deficit. And unlike the quantitative easing programs the Fed has had, this kind of an investment by the Fed in state infrastructure banks would result pretty quickly in increased employment in the country. It would help the construction industry tremendously, and that would have multiplier effects that would help the real economy in whatever regions those infrastructure banks exist in.
Well, couldn't the Fed itself directly invest in infrastructure without going through other banks?
I think it lacks the statutory authority to do that directly right now. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about reforming the Fed, both its governance structure and its mandate and authority to deal with the economic crisis. And these are some of the types of proposals that are being discussed on Capitol Hill right now by, I should say, elected leaders on both the right and the left of the spectrum.
Well, what happened in the 30s with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation?
Well, it's a fascinating history. When the stock market collapsed in 1929, Herbert Hoover, one of the responses of the Hoover administration was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And the RFC was used initially to bail out and prop up banks, insurance companies, railroads. And in the 1932 election, Franklin Roosevelt was running against Hoover, and Roosevelt criticized this use of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation as being just too timid. And Roosevelt called for using the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to make loans to state and local governments, to support local school teacher salaries, to help finance public works and infrastructure investment. And I think the way Roosevelt phrased it was that the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was being used for a top-down recovery, but what was needed was a bottom-up recovery. And in fact, after Roosevelt was elected, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was used for all those purposes that Roosevelt had proposed, and then some. Over the course of the 1930s and the 1940s, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was essentially a revolving fund, and over that period made over $50 billion of loans and investments, which was just a tremendous amount of money during the 30s and 40s. And those Reconstruction Finance Corporation funds went into public works. It helped finance an awful lot of construction in the country. It helped support local school teacher salaries. And it even, during the 1940s, helped create, to actually build major war industries in the petrochemical and armament industries.
And what do you think a WPA project today? First of all, do you think it's needed? And second of all, what would it do?
Well, first, yes, it's absolutely needed. We've got just too many people in this country who are out of work and looking for work. For every job opening, there's something like five or six people who are applying for jobs. There's just not enough. The private sector can't be expected to step in right now. It's a period of deleveraging where the private sector is busy trying to, you know, pay its bills, and it's just not willing to make the investments necessary to put people to work. And this is not unlike the 1930s. In the 1930s, the economy was also largely upside down, where millions of consumers and homeowners and businesses were underwater or going bankrupt. And it was only the public sector that could step in. And even today, we see all this talk about, let's say, in Western Europe, Italy and Greece and Spain, how much the public sector is borrowing. And actually, the public sector borrowing in each of those countries is much lower than the private sector borrowing as a percentage of gross domestic product. So it's clear that a public sector works program or programs are needed right now to start putting people to work and restoring confidence in the economy. And, you know, there's a lot of, I should say, ideological opposition to this, which I think is nonsense. You know, during the 1930s, Ronald Reagan's family was kept together through the Work Projects Administration, which employed his father in Dixon, Illinois.
Tim, we've only got a few minutes left, but did Roosevelt ever think about the Treasury itself printing money and not relying just on the Fed?
It's a very good question. Now, first of all, there was less need for it because the Fed was really not independent throughout much of the 1930s and 1940s in the way we think of Federal Reserve independence today. The Fed was essentially in an arrangement with Treasury where the Fed agreed to purchase Treasury debt in any amount and at any price necessary to keep the yields on Treasury borrowing down at 0.375% on short-term borrowing and 2.5% on long-term borrowing, no matter how much Treasury was borrowing. And Treasury was borrowing three times as much as today as a percentage of gross domestic product. But I should mention, just in direct answer to your question, in 1933, Congress passed the Agricultural Adjustment Act, and the Thomas Amendment to that act authorized the Treasury Department to basically issue up to $4 billion of greenbacks. That's, you know, Treasury-issued currency. Yes, yes. And you know, the last time this country had seen such an aggressive use of greenbacks was during the Civil War, where the Legal Tender Acts allowed Lincoln's Treasury Department to issue what at the time was an enormous amount of money, $450 million, about 40% of the money supply at its peak, to finance the Civil War.
So do you think that's an option today? I mean, well, obviously we'd need congressional approval.
I think it should be an option today. And I should mention that in 1999, a Republican congressman from Illinois named Ray LaHood, who is now President Obama's transportation secretary, LaHood in 1999 introduced a bill which would have had the Treasury Department make up to $360 billion in interest-free loans to state and local governments over a five-year period to pay for capital investments, you know, infrastructure investments. And the novelty of the LaHood bill was that Treasury would not be borrowing the money on the bond markets. Treasury would be essentially issuing credits in United States notes, the greenbacks. So, again, would not cost the taxpayers a penny and would not add to the deficit a penny. And that LaHood bill had the support of Dennis Kucinich on the left and Tom Campbell, a Republican congressman at the time, a Ph.D. University of Chicago school economist who had studied under Milton Friedman on the right. So it's those kinds of ideas that really need to be talked about, particularly at this time where we're stuck in this trap where people are thinking any time the federal government is going to spend money, it's got to find somewhere else to cut spending or raise taxes. And, you know, ideally it should be raising taxes on those who could afford to pay. You know, we see an incredible top-heavy distribution of wealth and income. But, you know, unfortunately, the political will is not there to be taxing the wealthy in any way, whether it's a financial transactions tax or a more progressivity in the income tax. You know, we just shouldn't be stuck in this trap where the only way we can have a public sector that invests in necessary programs, necessary infrastructure, necessary services such as our schools and our public services, police and firefighters, that the only way we can do that is to be cutting somewhere else or raising taxes. I'm hoping that ideas like Treasury issued currency will get more of a hearing in the months to come.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you a lot for bringing up some new ideas on this program. And we've been speaking to Tim Canova, who is a professor of international economic law at Chapman University School of Law. And let's start thinking about some of these ideas.
Thank you, Ken.
And now moving from Randy Newman's Mr. President, we go to a subject that Professor Canova talked about, that of state banks. And we hear from Dr. Roseanne Junker on the Bank of North Dakota.
The Bank of North Dakota is different from private bank in a very simple way. A private bank takes your deposits, and it pays you an interest on your deposit, and then it takes your money and lends your money to someone else and charges someone else more money than it's paying you, and it makes a difference in the spread. A state-owned bank has a different mission. Its mission is not to make a profit. Its mission is to serve the people of the state. It's able to take a really long-term view about what's the right thing to do for the people of the state at this moment in time. Right now, it's a $4 billion bank. It's capitalized with the state's earnings. It is paying interest on that money to the state treasurer, and it's using that money to create different lending opportunities for North Dakota family farms, for farmers who want to diversify, for students who want to go to college. When the Bank of North Dakota was being set up, it had been a state for 30 years. 95% of the people were engaged in farming. It was being, in the grossest terms, ripped off by the interests out of Minneapolis and St. Paul and Wall Street interests. And it was practically impossible to make a living at anything. If you would go to borrow $100 from the bank, you would come back with $68 because they charge you 12% interest and a $20 origination fee. And the farmers were really mad. The opponents of a state-owned bank did everything they could possibly do to stop it from being established. They took two challenges to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court said, if the citizens of the state want to do this, they should be able to do it. And then there's a drought in the 1920s, and these farmers just had to see that dream turn sour when they couldn't pay not only the principal, but the interest on the loan that they had with the bank. And people would write notes to the bank on a torn sheet of paper. I would send it to you, but I don't have any. We don't have a crop. I haven't had a crop this year. I didn't have a crop last year. They didn't have money to even feed themselves, much less to pay a bank loan. The bank tried to collect the money. The Bank of North Dakota representative would just say, I can't take money from these people. They don't have any. And it became very clear in the early 30s, and this is when Bill Langer was governor, and Bill Langer created a moratorium on debt. So the bank stopped doing any kind of foreclosure and then allowed them to stay on the farms. When the economy turned around in the early 1940s, the bank sold those farms back to the original farmer at the price the bank had in them. The Bank of North Dakota is doing amazingly well, given the worldwide economic crisis that we're in. It's as strong as it's ever been. The fact that it isn't suffering any of the fallout from the financial crisis that the other banks are, I think attests to really the strength of the bank and actually the bank's mission. And they didn't invest in risky derivatives. They didn't buy any subprime home loans. It didn't fit the way that they did business. During the last 90 years, the bank has returned $500 million to the state's general fund. What that means is the state has been able to develop programs, $500 million worth of programs, without taxing the people of the state to do those programs. It really, in my mind, it doesn't matter if it's socialism or capitalism. You know, what matters is what works best for the people, what provides the most services at the least cost.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.